Now for the sermon, Mr. Buchanan.
Helps to have one of these. Well, I didn't take the opportunity to welcome the Rolls again from South Dakota, but welcome from a former South Dakotan. Oh, there you are. Okay, so I hadn't met you yet, and you were here last week, right? So, and we have other guests that I'm sorry if I don't have your names yet, but we'll get to know each other afterwards. And so, but I don't know if you were in a church in South Dakota back in the 80s, late 80s. So we were on the West Riverside in South Dakota in Rapid City. That's the nature of the nature of how things go in South Dakota. You're either East River, West River, states divided by the Missouri River. So you probably live in the city, I'm sure. And do you live in Sioux Falls or
Mitchell?
Okay, so and they have a famous tourist attraction in Mitchell called the Corn Palace. You can Google it or look it up. I'm not going to get into that now, but anyway, so it was nice to have you here. I guess you decided that you didn't want to go back to the cold, wintry blasts of the North Plains, but glad you're here. Have you ever been confused or puzzled by the subject of judging? Because Matthew chapter 7 seems to indicate, at least, that you shouldn't judge. And yet, how can you be human and not come to opinions? It just seems to be the way that we are. But so many times people get kind of crossways about making judgments and maybe a little bit confused. And, you know, we all do rush to judgment at times, but it seems as though we are told here in the first couple of verses of Matthew 7 not to judge. It says, "Judge not that you be not judged. For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. And with what measure you use, it will be measured back to you." So it almost seems to tell you that you better be careful, you better not do it. But you're already ahead of me, and you know that the greater intent here is not to condemn. It's not really not to have a judgment, not to have an opinion, because we all do have opinions. And actually, it raises a funny issue. I was talking to a Hungarian doctor that I call on, and she told me that there is a small Hungarian community here. She was born in Hungary, she trained in Hungary, and then moved here in the 70s along with her husband. But she said, there's a small community of Hungarians in Tucson, and they're always squabbling. They're always disagreeing with one another. They're always getting upset. And I said, "Well, why is that?" And she says, "Well, it goes back to an old Hungarian proverb, and it kind of talks about how we are. Whenever you get two Hungarians together, you'll have three opinions on everything." But we all have opinions. In verse 3, it says, "Why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but don't consider the plank in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, 'Let me remove the speck from your eye,' and look, a plank is in your own eye? Hypocrite, first remove the plank from your own eye, and then you'll see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye." Aha, so it shows that judging can be right. It can be appropriate and something that a Christian has to do. In fact, I think learning to judge properly is probably one of the greatest skills a Christian can develop. Christ says in Luke chapter 12, he also comments in many other places about having discernment, judgment, and that sort of thing. But in Luke chapter 12, verses 54 through 57, we read that then he said to the multitudes, "Whenever you see a cloud rising out of the west, and immediately you say, 'A shower is coming,' and so it is." You're able to understand weather patterns. And probably before the 10 o'clock weatherman, people had a much better way of judging weather than we do. Now we simply don't know. If you watch the weather report, you really you see all the conditions that happen today, but you know what's going to happen is always a mystery. So maybe they knew more about the weather than we do now with all of our technology. "And when you see the south wind blow, you say there will be hot weather, and There is. Hypocrites, you can discern the face of the sky and of the earth, but how do you not discern this time? So discernment, or being able to judge in a proper way, is a skill that I think is one of the most important talents that can be developed by a Christian. It's certainly something all of us probably should be working on. So there shouldn't really be any confusion. We should be able to judge. We should be able to come to decisions, be able to, in fact, even help each other in the church of God. One of the saddest aspects of the news media sometimes is that someone can be accused of something in the news, or maybe even be arrested for something, and then automatically the stain of guilt accompanies him. Now, there are a lot of criminals out there, and don't get me wrong, I'm all for all the criminals, all the people who've done the bad things. Boy, I want justice to rain down on them. But do you remember the incident in 1996, the Olympics in Atlanta, Georgia, and there was a bomb plot? Do you remember that? They found out, they uncovered that there was a homegrown terrorist, apparently, that was planning on setting off a bomb. And they made an arrest, and they captured a guy, and I can't remember how long they kept him, but a long time later, they had to admit, I think it was the FBI that got this guy after profiling him and everything else, he wasn't the guy. He didn't do anything wrong. He had, like a lot of people, he may have had a lot of guns in his house. He may have seemed like he was a likely suspect, but when it was all said and done, he was innocent. And sometimes in our societies today, people rush to judgment and rush to come to a conclusion. And it's kind of a sad thing. And, I'm not saying that it happens all the time, but it happens often enough that, or situations like this, people get let go because of a technicality in the law. Maybe the Miranda rights weren't given to the suspect, and maybe he is guilty, but maybe he had a lesser sentence or a light sentence, or maybe even none at all. So we hear of those things from time to time. I believe that probably most of the time the legal system can work, but we do live in an age in which very often there are inequities because man cannot judge properly and doesn't have judgment in the proper way. Back in Matthew, once again in Matthew 7, Christ says that one of the problems that people can have is that when they lose their boundaries, lose their foundation of law, then judgment disappears as well. This is what happened in that era of the Bible that Mr. Correa was reading in, the time of the judges. There wasn't good judgment except for a few. There weren't righteous judges all over the land, and they had begun to that gradual drift away from the commandments of God, and because of that, they really lost judgment and lost the ability to have that kind of wisdom that the law of God gives. Matthew 7 and verse 21, Christ says, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven." Doing the will of God is being obedient to the law, obedient to the commandments. It's really a foundation for wisdom anyway, as we know. "Many will say to me in that day, 'Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, cast out demons in your name, and done many wonders in your name?' And I will declare to them, 'I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness or iniquity.'" So it's at the very foundation of good judgment is obedience and understanding the law of God. "Whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on a rock." You do the law of God, you've got one step in the right direction. If you're obedient to God, another step in the direction to being able to understand, to have discernment, and being able to judge properly. Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock, and the rain descended, the floods came, the winds blew and beat on that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. But everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. So when we put the scriptures together, God's law is essential in preserving and protecting righteous judgment. And as our society inches further and further away from this law, as it seems to be doing on a yearly basis, as it seems to be more of a stranger to this book and to its very foundations, then we will see lesser and lesser wisdom and judgment in our societies. It's just a natural consequence of departure from the law. Ancient Israel and Judah proved it. They departed from the law of God, and judgment in their societies departed. And it has happened that way throughout history. And when you lose wisdom, lose discretion, lose discernment, then your society begins to fall apart. The undergirding of your life needs to be then the law of God. I suppose I could quit right there, but I should speak 45 to 50 minutes, so I will continue to give you a few other points here. In Ephesians chapter 4, verses 17 through 24, Paul was speaking to a group of people, obviously, who lived in a Greek society. This is modern-day Turkey today, but it was a part of Asia Minor that was governed by the Greeks anciently, the 300s AD, and there was certainly a great deal of Greek influence. And, you know, the Greek societies, it was the Roman world also, but Greek societies, the Roman world, they had their laws, they had their rule of law to a certain degree, but nothing like we've had in our nation. But Paul was speaking to people who had lived in a world that was governed by maybe the wisdom of this world, you know, the wisdom that had been developed by man from the beginning of time, the beginning of man's time on this earth. And it was man's wisdom, not God's wisdom, and oftentimes that goes awry. The practice of kind of figuring out for yourself how to do things without any clear understanding from God, it all falls apart, eventually does, and most of our lives before our calling, you know, we may have been governed by a sense of right and wrong. We may have even had the blessing of growing up and being taught the Ten Commandments. I know I did. I did not grow up in the church, as I've mentioned many times, came in as an 18-year-old. But, you know, anybody that has at least some kind of foundation in this book, in this law, is going to have a little bit more judgment. They're going to, if their lives are rooted in the obedience to the Ten Commandments, that's great for them, and that's wonderful. But these folks, these Ephesians, certainly weren't exposed to that until their calling, for the most part, because they were not Jews, as they did not have as many Jews, shall we say. The church was of Greek descent. So in verse 17, "This I say, therefore, and testify in the Lord, that you should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk, in the futility of their mind." They do not have appropriate judgment, having their understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them, because of the blindness of their heart. You know, they were in a civilization as probably as advanced as it got, you know, in that part of the world, as advanced as the world was at that particular time, but it was still very, very dark, comparatively speaking, to what it could have been had it been predicated on the law of God. It was predicated by Greek wisdom and Greek law and Roman law, because it was governed by the Romans. But there was a blindness there because, again, they didn't know right from wrong. "Who being past feeling have given themselves over to lewdness, to work all uncleanness with greediness." You know, in one sense, certainly not their fault. That's the way they grew up. That's how they learned. But Paul said, "You have not so learned Christ, if indeed you have heard him and have been taught by him as the truth is in Jesus, that you put off concerning your former conduct the old man which grows corrupt according to the deceitful lusts, and be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and that you put on the new man which was created according to God in true righteousness and holiness." He's obviously talking about conversion. He's talking about understanding the basis of law, understanding the nature of God and accepting it, accepting the premise that you repent over that behavior, and it applies to all mankind because we've all come out of a world. You know, it may have been a little closer to the truth than theirs was, but still, we've all come out of that world, and I think we can all look back on our lives. We can all say, yep, not so good, better than maybe the Ephesians, because we at least we weren't practicing the idolatry of worshiping to the goddess Diana, as the Ephesians were, the goddess of love and lewdness. I mean, it was lewd. It was totally lewd. The temple prostitutes and the whole thing. It's a great study to look into how that entire society was so infiltrated with that kind of false religion. But to a certain extent, Paul is describing the condition of all of us, not just these people in Ephesus. He's showing that there is a process of change that takes place, and it takes place over a period of time. And eventually, this growth process enables or will enable the church of God here, the people of God, to benefit the entire human race. That's the destiny of God's people. So it would seem logical then, if that is what we are going to do, as Paul mentions in 1 Corinthians 6, if that is where we are going, that we are given opportunities in this life to exercise the judgment of Christ. And we must indeed, with the mind of Christ, exercise that judgment. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 2 and 3, Paul said to them, a society that was much like Ephesus, as a matter of fact, because even though it was a long ways from Ephesus, still, across a huge body of water in the, I don't know if that would be the Adriatic Sea, it possibly would be, just thinking in my mind right now what that would be today, or what the name would be today. But do you not know that the saints will judge the world? And if the world will be judged by you, are you unworthy to judge the smallest matters? Do you not know that we shall judge angels? How much more things that pertain to this life? So, rather than thinking that Matthew 7 prohibits you from being a judge, the Bible emphasizes that you must become a judge. So you've got to be good at it because you've got to exercise God's judgment and not personal judgment. So we should also realize that we probably, like I have, we probably all failed a little bit miserably on this particular test from time to time. But we are learning to do in this life what we are expected to apply as principle when the world in the angelic realm is judged. Now, the words judge, judging, and judgment have a lot of synonyms in the Bible, and you have to be aware of the context, obviously. Everything is a matter of context when you're looking at the words like judge. The word judge can be arbitrator, magistrate, court, could mean justice. It could mean to consider or to reckon. That was an Old West term, I reckon. To regard, to esteem, to determine, to decide, to conclude, try. I have to write those down, but they're all synonyms that are implied in reading through the Bible on the term judge. And judgment can mean discernment, having discretion, having wisdom, having understanding. Not a new thing. All of this is predicated on understanding the law of God. That's what gives the Christian his ultimate ability to judge, along with conversion and how to apply it and, you know, when to do things, when not to do things. Through every generation, Christians have had to deal with judgment, and we're no different. And it actually is one of the most important things, as I said before, one of the most important skills that I believe that a Christian can develop, or talents, because it seems as though most people, especially in this country, most people are born with an opinion. We all have opinions, don't we? And, you know, we seem to have that. So it'd be great to be able to have that opinion moderated with the law of God. And that's our ultimate goal. We are being trained to help people in the times ahead. Who knows how far ahead that is, but that is a part of your training. That is why you're here today, to be able to be trained appropriately so that you can help judge the world and help judge the angelic realm in whatever manner and practice that is. It's not exactly clear in terms of the judgment of the angelic realm, because it would appear that their judgment is kind of set. But that is what Paul told the Corinthians, that that is part of our destiny. That is what we are to, that is what we are to become. You know, even a far greater destiny than Darth Vader gave to his son Luke. You know, come with me, we'll rule the universe, you know, blah, blah. That didn't really happen. I hate to offend the Star Wars fans, but there wasn't a time long ago in a world far away. It's kind of an interesting series. Last three movies were pretty bad, and the first one was actually pretty good. But anyway, it really makes sense that one of our main goals is to learn to judge not from man's point of view, but with righteous judgment. As it says in John 7:24, do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. It seems as though a lot of people judged things according to the appearance in 1996, when this person is arrested, his face is plastered all over TV and in every news report. It was a big deal. He seemed to, you know, seemed to look guilty in one sense too. You know, if I think that if any of us were accused of a crime like that and we were nabbed by the FBI and they got us wide-eyed and scared, I bet we'd all look guilty of something, wouldn't we? No one's laughing. What have you people been doing? Let's turn to the chapter 6 of 1 Corinthians once again. While you try to throw me off my game by not laughing at my humor, then I'm just going to take that as a challenge. And I will, before the day is through, make at least one person laugh, even if it's only me. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 1, dare any of you, having a matter against another, go to law before the unrighteous and not before the saints? Now, the Corinthians had a lot of problems. Paul was speaking of a very difficult situation. We won't go into that at this particular time, but there was something that they should have appropriately and properly judged, as we know that they didn't, and they had accepted it. It was a very laissez-faire, you know, kind of a society that developed in the 60s in our country, you know, live and let live, and it can permeate. This attitude was very similar at that particular time, kind of very democratic. Everything is, you know, it's not in my business, so I can't do anything about it, or I shouldn't do anything about it. Now, I don't want a rash of a bunch of people making judgments and accusing people after this sermon or anything else, but there's no situation I'm talking about or anything now. But it's just a matter of using this as an example that Paul said that there were situations that they should have judged or determined in an appropriate way using the law of God. In verse 4, he says, if then you have judgments concerning things pertaining to this life, do you appoint those who are least esteemed by the church to judge? It's almost sarcasm dripping there. I say this to your shame. Is it so that there's not a wise man among you, not even one who will be able to judge or discern between his brethren? But brother goes to law against brother, and that before unbelievers. Now, therefore, it is already an utter failure for you to go to law against one another. Why do you not rather accept wrong? Why would you not rather let yourselves be cheated? It'd be better, Paul said, you know, than to try to thrash some instances out in the courts of that day. No, you yourselves do wrong and cheat, and you do these things to your brethren. So wisdom and judgment work together. Let's turn to James. Here's, along with the law of God, which we've talked about, which helps provide wisdom to everybody, and certainly the predicated on the Ten Commandments, one thing that the Bible says is that in terms of arriving at appropriate judgments, you've got to begin with another base too. In James 3 and verse 17, it says that the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruit, without partiality and without hypocrisy. That's the beginning stage. You probably the antithesis of that is the guys that look guilty in the Old West, the town, they're strangers, and somebody has been shot, and the only buddy that's new in that town are these two guys that just rode in. And within an hour, somebody is killed, and all of a sudden, the finger points at them, and then they put them in jail for their own protection, right? You've seen these movies. They put them in jail for their own protection, and pretty soon, over at the saloon, a couple of guys with too many beers decided those guys have to be guilty, and they killed their best friend, and there's a frenzied mob with pitchforks and torches, and they storm the jail, right? Have you seen that movie? I don't know the name of it. I just made this all up, but it's certainly not a pure, peaceable, gentle, willing to yield type of situation. But, you know, I picked this up a number of years ago, that the most exercise some people get is jumping to conclusions, running down other people, and sidestepping responsibility. So, wisdom is pure, peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality. Christ said in Matthew 7, of course, we have already read, that, you know, you have to correct yourself sometimes first. You may have to do some introspective looking before you're willing to make a judgment on somebody else's behalf. You better take a look at that yourself. Anybody that has had kids, and I've got three of them, anybody that's had kids realizes that your children have this tendency to see things from their own point of view. When they have a disagreement or an argument, they have a tendency to see it from only their point of view. And they want to blame their brother or their sister or their sister or their brother for, you know, something, and they think that they're wrong in some way, but they have not learned this particular trait, that it's good to, you know, take that out of your own eye first. Now, another way to develop judgment, or another manner of judging, is also found again in Matthew 7. Let's turn back there to Matthew 7, verses 15 through 20. A lot of good information in Matthew 7, obviously. But Christ said, "Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they're ravenous wolves. You will know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Even so, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit." Now, I've got a tree in my backyard that bears bad fruit. We've talked about cutting it down. I don't know if I will. I don't know what kind of lemon tree this is. Somebody in Sierra Vista told me that's really a lemon. But it is a lemon tree that has the oddest looking fruit on it. And I was talking with a physician friend of mine, and I was describing this tree. And I don't know why they planted this kind of tree. Why would you plant a lemon tree that when you open up the lemons, it's just chock full of seeds? Don't they have seedless lemons nowadays? Isn't the technology advanced far enough? I mean, there's like a disproportionate number. You're telling me no? Do you really know these things? There's seedless oranges, aren't there? I think there are. Aren't there seedless lemons? Does anybody know? That was not a seedless. It's a seed full of seed full lemon. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And the juice in it tastes horrid. It's awful. I water it. I fertilized it. It looks like a perfectly normal tree, but when you cut the lemon open, it is disgusting. It is awful. And the outside of this lemon is like, the skin is, how would you describe it? Lumpy. Yeah, it's weird. It is a lemon. Yes, it is. It's not a grapefruit or some strange. Yes, it is a lemon. I know it is a lemon. It smells like a lemon, but it is awful. Terry makes great lemon meringue pies. She would never touch these lemons or this lemon juice. I got a juicer because, you know, one year the lemons did not, the first couple years they didn't produce, but then all of a sudden, magically these lemons started coming out. And I thought, oh, I'll get a lemon juicer and we'll make some lemonade. This will be great. You know, and it tasted awful. It's horrible. Bad fruit. I have the prior owner to blame for that tree. But I've got myself to blame for Ozzy in the front yard. Ozzy is, for those of you that are visiting, Ozzy is the name of the crepe myrtle that I planted that I think my son cursed, actually. I don't think this is possible, but I'd like to blame him because he helped me plant it, and he named it Ozzy in honor of Ozzy, the rock star, the rocker. His mind is destroyed with drugs and alcohol and everything else, you know, married to Sharon. Osborne. And the tree is kind of like that. It's horrible. The tree has not grown. I think I've tried to do my – admittedly, I have not taken the best care of him, too. But anyway, we're giving him one more chance this spring. He's got a chance to grow. If he doesn't, then he and the fruit tree are both going to get the axe. So, but you judge them by their fruits. Verse 20, therefore, by their fruits you will know them. Well, in this case, I don't think Jesus had experience with this lemon tree that I had because I can't really tell. What if it looks like someone is bearing bad fruit? How do we proceed? What should we do? You know, like the situation in Atlanta, Georgia, they probably should have taken some time before they jumped to a conclusion here on this individual. Some of the best management advice that I ever received was from a boss that I had who I'd actually asked him this question. I may have shared this with you before. What's the best piece of management advice that you've been given by anybody you've worked for? And he said, you know, Jim, he said, it's always good to sleep on something. You know, of course, if it's a matter of life and death and you have to make a decision now, you got to move quickly. You got to do it. You got to go. You know, I mean, an emergency situation, you know, you just have to react, right? It's the fight or the flight syndrome. You have to rely on your judgment as best as you can in an emergency situation. But there are a lot of situations in life that aren't emergencies, don't have to be dealt with right now. It's not a matter of life and death. You know, the circumstances are not going to change significantly if you just wait on it a little bit. And waiting on it sometimes is a good thing. But the religious people of the day thought that Christ was a liar and he was a poor example. And some of the disciples of John the Baptist came to Christ in Luke chapter 7, verses 20 through 23. I'll read there. They were wondering about Jesus. John the Baptist even had questions. You know, are you the one that we should be looking for? Is there somebody else? When the men had come to him, they said, John the Baptist has sent us to you, saying, are you the coming one, or do we look for another? And at that very hour, he cured many of infirmities, afflictions, and evil spirits, and to many blind he gave sight. And Jesus answered and said to them, go and tell John the things that you have seen and heard, that the blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised. The poor have the gospel preached to them, and blessed is he who is not offended because of me. He told Philip to believe me for my work's sake. You know, or in other words, what is the result of my life, my fruit, my labors? What do you see? Too often people can hear something about somebody and quickly believe it without further thinking. It's happened to us as well. Wouldn't it be better? Wouldn't it be a good practice to think it through? I picked up five basic things to think about. I'm not saying that I've always done them, so, you know, please consider the imperfect vessel that is before you. So I'm not claiming, you know, any superiority over these things, but I still nonetheless think that they are good to remember. You know, just like the old proverb that your mother told you, you know, if you can't say anything good about somebody. How many of you had a mother that told you that? I had 100% down in, what happened to the child rearing in your life anyway? I had 100% in Sierra Vista. Everybody raised their hands. And, you know, so the corollary to that would be, you know, don't believe everything you hear, right? You know, you've probably heard that. But number one, consider the source of the rumor. Consider the source of a, well, we won't even make it a rumor. Let's just say, consider the source. Is it a logical statement? There's some things that just people accept, and you sit back and you think, really? Are you kidding me? How could you accept that? Point number two, what proof is there? What is the proof? Mr. Armstrong was fond of saying, when people would bring him accusations about somebody, he'd say, were you there? Were you there? Point number three, is it consistent with the person's background and reputation? I mean, wouldn't it be great if our system has to have politics in it, wouldn't it be great if there were none of the slimy, mudslinging type of ads about how bad the other guy is? Just incredible. This is simple. Could it have really happened? I mean, some things are so outrageous. Could it have really happened? Well, I guess anything is possible, but seriously, could it have happened? And how would Christ handle this? This happens in life. It happened in the Bible. Turn to Joshua 22. Here is an example that I think is just a classic in terms of, and I think it's one that's so universal that we can relate to because it happens nearly every day. Something like this, which is basically a misunderstanding, something like this happens daily. And notice all the buzzwords associated that have been preserved, I think, very beautifully in the Bible. I think that's the best thing about this, is all these buzzwords and words that can incite are preserved in the Bible for us to see this. All the hot button words that are mentioned here. I'm just going to cite some of them for you. As you read through this, notice these hot button words: treachery, iniquity, unclean, rebel, and trespass. You know, all these words are in this particular example, and I'm going to shorten it up here a little bit, because what happened was, when they were entering into the promised land, half the tribe of Manasseh, Gad, who we think became eventually the Swiss people, and Reuben, who we think probably are the historical antecedents of the French for the most part, they decided that they would stay on the east side of Jordan. All the other tribes would inherit the land. And they decided, oh, this is where we'd like to be. You know, this is nice. This is good for us. The rest of them went across. You remember the priests went down in the Jordan River. The Jordan River stacked up for miles and miles ahead so they could walk through, you know, kind of like walking through the Red Sea all over again. But this is the Jordan River around the time of the spring holy days that year, 40 years later. So they decided, half tribe of Manasseh, Gad, and Reuben, they decided, you know what? It would be a good idea to build a memorial here so that we don't forget, and so that our children don't forget, and our children's children don't forget their brothers and sisters over on the other side of that river, that we're all basically joined together. It was a nice thought. It was a nice thought. But it got totally, totally misinterpreted here in Joshua chapter 22. And, you know, the whole thing got to be kind of crazy and out of control. It shows you how things can happen. And, you know, you've played that rumor game, I'm sure, where you have 20 people in a room and everybody whispers something original to begin with, and then to the other end. And then some, you know, it's not only the subject to interpretation. People kind of cheat the game by kind of changing it wholesale themselves, but still, you get the point. You can probably do that game a little bit better with young kids who are a little bit less purposefully deceiving and will, you know, honestly just misinterpret something that they heard and tell it to the next person. But so they, in verse 10, it says, when they came to the region of Jordan, which is in the land of Canaan, the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh built an altar there by the Jordan, a great impressive altar. Now, it wasn't an altar to sacrifice, and that's explained throughout the story. It was a memorial, basically, just like, you know, we go to Washington, D.C., you see the Jefferson Memorial, you see the Lincoln Memorial, you see all kinds of memorials all over the place, just things to remember those individuals, and they did it for the right person. Now the children of Israel heard someone say, "Behold, the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh have built an altar on the frontier of the land of Canaan in the region of the Jordan on the children of Israel's side." And when the children of Israel heard of it, the whole congregation, the children of Israel, gathered together at Shiloh to go to war against them. You know, they're going to wipe them off the face of the earth because they're doing something incredibly evil or wicked. They're going to build another altar except the one at Shiloh. Besides the one at Shiloh, they're going to build this false altar, this altar to pagan gods and everything else. And so that rumor just spread like crazy. And cooler heads apparently prevailed, and they sent leaders. They talked to them first before, you know, getting the swords on and going across the Jordan River to exterminate them all. And they found out the truth, and that's explained a little bit later. You can read it. After they, you know, and if, you know, they didn't give them time. Okay, what are you doing? They never asked the question, "What are you doing?" First of all, you know, everything was done wrong here. Everything was done wrong. You didn't even ask them what they're doing. They basically gave them a lecture and told them they're going to kill them all if they didn't repent of this. And in verse 21, it says, "Then the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, half the tribe of Manasseh answered and said to the heads of the divisions of Israel, 'The Lord God of gods, the Lord of gods, he knows, and let Israel itself know that if it's in rebellion or in treachery against the Lord, do not save us this day. If we have built ourselves an altar to turn from following the Lord or to offer on it burnt offerings or grain offerings or offer peace offerings on it, let the Lord himself require an account. But in fact, we have done it for fear, for a reason, saying, in time to come, your descendants may speak to your descendants, saying, what have you to do with the God of Israel? For the Lord has made the Jordan a border between you and us, your children of Reuben and children of Gad, and you have no part in the Lord. So your descendants would make our descendants cease fearing the Lord. Therefore, we said, let us now prepare to build ourselves an altar, not for burnt offering nor for sacrifice, but that it may be a witness between you and us and our generations after us, that we may perform the service of the Lord before him with our burnt offerings, with our sacrifices, with our peace offerings, that your descendants may not say to our descendants in times to come, you have no part with us.'" And it all pleased them. But notice verse 11. Someone heard someone say something. How many horrible things have begun this way? How many rumors have begun this? Somebody heard somebody say something. And then verse 12, the whole congregation heard it, because obviously bad news travels so fast, and it does. And then verses 13 through 20 describe jumping to conclusions, all of them false, before getting all the facts, not listening, not giving the other party an opportunity to explain before the judgment is rendered. So this happens everywhere, and it's going to happen again. It's a shame that it does. It's happened within the church. It's very unfortunate. I suppose enough time has passed. I mean, read the humorous, the report Mr. Kubik sent about the cow walking 5 miles back to its original order, it came out this week. It's not the predication of the sermon. Actually, I gave this sermon before. It's going to be very shocking to some of you who think that I come up with an original idea every week. But I gave this sermon probably 12, 13, 14 years ago. Years ago, right after United first started, because it was a problem then, and it is a problem now. And it's unfortunate that, you know, I mean, if we think things went through the people of Israel fast at the time, I can tell you that I was very offended that things said about some of my friends, some of my dear friends, not that I'm buddy-buddy with them. Some of them are older than me. Roy Holiday is, of course, a lot older than I am. Who else? Denny Luker is, you know, 75, so he's 15 years at least older than I am. But I've known these men ever since I've been in the church. And for me to read things from gossipy internet sources and sites of unnamed persuasion really was offensive. And unfortunately, that formed the basis for a schism in the church. Now, I've heard people say, well, there's bad on both sides. No, really. No, we didn't engage. The United Church of God didn't engage in any rumor mongering or gossip about other people or to tear down the institution that was there. And it's very unfortunate, in my opinion. It could have been avoided. Problems were there. Some of my friends were at the forefront of that, and it's very unfortunate. But I'm telling you that for us to be able to render appropriate judgment We have to have all of those things that the scriptures mention: mercy, faith, forgiveness, willingness, being entreated. And it's unfortunate that, you know, mankind goes along. Eventually he'll, you know, he's just blindly groping his way without having the foundation of law like we do, not able to solve its problems, never will be, and, you know, eventually will lead to Christ's return. But in this particular example, it shows that, you know, it's good to consider all sides of a statement, pray about it, and wait. Decide what to do when you've had time to think and pray and consider. And, you know, removing the speck out of your own eye, right? And that's a good thing always to do. And when you've gone through all those steps, remember the management advice of my friend Jim, who was told by one of his mentors, you know, maybe you should sleep on it. Maybe you should do that. So, unfortunately, the first initial reason that I prepared this sermon was because right after we began in 1995, the pain, the agony was still there, still evident. 15 years ago was there. People were hurting, and, you know, they were hurting so badly because they had been scarred, and they had been scarred by something that they had placed a great deal of trust and emphasis in, an institution that they thought would never fail, a church institution that they thought would always be there for them, and they saw it slowly crumble before their eyes, and it was very difficult. And they came out of it, but it still did wreak some havoc in their lives. And that's the original reason that I gave this particular message. But I turned to Ephesians 6 and verse 16. It says that we are to take the shield of faith, which with which you'll be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one. And I saw things written about my friends from people who are unnamed, and I just didn't believe them because I know probably, I think I could probably be in safe ground. I know these men better than anybody here, better than anybody that's been here in the Tucson church for many years. I'm pretty safe in saying that. I've talked to them. I've conversed with them. I've discussed the goals and aspirations of all of God's people with them, and therefore I know them to be humble. And I'm just picking two individuals out. I know them to be humble men and people who are merciful. And, you know, I hated to see what was happening to them. And there were other friends of mine who were on the opposite side of that argument that I was just astounded at, to be honest with you. I was just shocked at what happened. So I'm not going to, you know, spend any more time on it, except to say that it's sad. But faith is a protective device for a Christian that enables those fiery darts to be quenched. And we live in an age where those fiery darts may be, you know, it may be gossip, it may be innuendo. In some cases, there may be some truth to a matter. That doesn't necessarily make the whole situation right that is being spoken about. You know, there's so much in terms of attitude. When you exercise the faith of God, you lessen the chance that someone else will have their lives, their reputations called into question. Remember those 5 points applied earlier when you begin to hear things, because there is a devil, and he's not going to give up. He's not going to give up attacking the people of God, never will. But basically, we are the kind of people that have to be our brother's keeper. Notice what it says in Romans chapter 14. Now, this was addressing a different topic. I don't mean to lift the lesson out of context or anything, but Romans chapter 14, beginning in verse 10, it says, but why do you judge your brother? And this is condemn your brother. Why do you show contempt for your brother? For we shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. For it is written, as I live, says the Lord, every knee shall bow to me and every tongue shall confess to God. And then each of us shall give account of himself to God. Therefore, let us not judge, condemn one another anymore, but rather resolve this: not to put a stumbling block or cause to fall in our brother's way. Now, in this particular instance, Paul is dealing with a totally different thing. He's dealing with the matter of whether you should eat meat that is sacrificed to idols, or whether it's in a marketplace, or whether you should eat meat on some days or not on some days. You know, the Romans had these strange, weird customs, and some people felt that, you know, they were still obliged to keep those. And Paul was saying, you know, you just have to be careful not to throw a stumbling block in front of somebody, and because it could hurt them. You know, it's, you don't put obstacles in somebody else's way. Even when a report is true, our duty as Christians is to exercise justice, mercy, and faith. And we extend mercy to those who repent. We have faith that God is big enough to take care of the problems that we may not have judgment in, or we may not be able to judge appropriately. We may not have enough information to judge appropriately. It's unfortunate in that sense. I'm going to cite, what is it, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5 quick passages. Now, I have tried to slow myself down because, as I've told you, I keep my notes, most of my topics on the iPad here, most of the scriptures on the iPad. Sometimes I'll turn, but I forget that I've already got this here and you've got to turn to it. So I've tried to slow down because I want to be sensitive to that. I'm going too fast. But don't worry about looking these up. You can write them down, though, if you want to, because I'm just going to close with these 5 passages. They all are very, very close in the Bible together, but let me just read them. Leviticus 19 and verse 16. Here's a dose of New Testament theology, you might say, in the Old Testament. It's all one book, but there's no law introduced in the New Testament that is different than that which was already given to Israel. But you shall not go about as a talebearer among your people, nor shall you take a stand against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. It'd have been great if some internet websites would kind of review this information, you know, this ancient 3,500-year-old document, rather than trying to invent and thinking they're doing God a service. Okay, that's my feeling anyway. Even if something seems to be true, even if somebody has done wrong, seems to be right, it's against the law. Shouldn't do it. Proverbs 11, verse 13, a talebearer reveals secrets, but he who is of a faithful spirit conceals matter. There were secrets that were exposed to people that I know in the church. It's like people have never read this stuff before. No, you're not supposed to do that. So I evaluate all of that which happened by this information. Proverbs 18 and verse 18, the words of a talebearer are like tasty trifles, and they go down into the innermost body. Proverbs 20 and verse 19, he who goes about as a talebearer reveals secrets. Therefore, do not associate with one who flatters with his lips. Proverbs 26, 20, where there is no wood, the fire goes out, and where there is no talebearer, strife ceases. I have been in a number of, in private business, in my company, I've been in other companies, I've been in a number of, we're organized in a district fashion. We have 10 or 15 representatives who form a geographical district. And so most of the time, most of the people I'm dealing with are pretty high caliber people, even the individual that I will kind of mention. Very high caliber people, highly educated, all motivated, usually work together very well as a team, even though we don't have any business association with each other because we have different geographical responsibility. But usually when we get together, we have a good time. We found that, this was a couple of years ago, we found that one highly educated, very highly motivated individual actually was, you know, when we evaluated it afterwards, somewhat disruptive to the overall organization of things. And, you know, once that particular presence was gone, then everybody was happier magically. It just happened that way. That's just the nature of what had happened. It probably has happened in your workplace as well. God holds all of us morally and legally responsible to uphold his laws of love, which, as Christ said in Matthew 7, means that we're to treat each other with what has been called or come to be known as the golden rule. And I wrote this sentence. I left it in I left it in. It was 14 years old. Until the United Church of God makes sufficient progress in this area, our spiritual growth will be stunted. You are the United Church of God, and this applies personally to each and every member. I decided, I'll leave that in because I wrote it for that time. It's certainly appropriate at this time. Using righteous judgment helps us to grow ourselves, helps others to overcome and to grow as well. If we don't speak evil of each other, but we pray for and encourage and build on each other's strong points, we will be a much stronger church organization. So remember Paul's example as he said, I imitate Christ. He said, imitate me as I also imitate Christ. And let's do all that we can to handle the decision, any decision that we would make, any judgment that we would come to. All the wisdom and discernment comes from him, and that's what we should utilize in being judges.